You're listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm your host, William Cooper. Fable of Isis and Osiris, as it has descended to us in the account given by Plutarch, has not been greatly amplified by any modern research. The Egyptian fragments, which have been translated in recent years, offer no complete account of the birth, life, death, and resurrection of Osiris, nor has any new key been found to unlock this great drama, which may well be termed the Passion Play of Egypt. It is not our intention to perpetuate Plutarch's account merely for its outward appearance, but rather from the same motive that inspired Synesius, Platonic philosopher and Christian bishop, to compile his account of the same fabulous history. Synesius, in his treatise on Providence, and you hear that word a lot in the secret societies and especially in Freemasonry, thus introduces the Osirian myth. Quote, "This fable is Egyptian. The Egyptians transcend in wisdom. Perhaps, therefore, this also being a fable, obscurely signifies something more than a fable, because it is Egyptian. If, however, it is not a fable, but a sacred discourse, it will deserve in a still greater degree to be told and committed to writing." Unquote. In presenting a summary of Plutarch's account, I am omitting nothing which could in any way be regarded as relevant. I am taking the liberty, however, of somewhat expanding the fable by incorporating therein some small fragments derived from other Greek writers, and occasionally a few words bearing upon the account from fragments of Egyptian religious literature. The story, then, is in substance as follows. The goddess Nut, whom Plutarch identifies with Rhea, was the daughter of Shu and Tefnut. She is the wife of Seb, also known as Saturn, and the mother of Ra, or Helios, also known as the sun. Now, if we're to trust Plutarch, she afterwards becomes the wife of Ra, or the sun. Nut is unfaithful to Ra, who, discovering that she is with child by Seb, pronounces a curse upon her that she should not be delivered of her progeny in any month or year. Thoth, which is Hermes or Mercury, who is also in love with Nut, comes to her assistance with a stratagem. He plays at tables with the moon goddess, Selene, and wins from her the 70th part of each of her illuminations. And joining these parts together, he forms of them 5 days, which he adds to the calendar. Previous to that time, the Egyptian year consisted of 360 days, the exact number of degrees in a circle. Now, these 5 days being not part of any month or year, Ra was outwitted. You see, because upon these days, Nut brought forth her 5 children at different times in different places. Upon the first of these days, she brought forth Osiris, and the place of his birth, according to Diodorus, was Mount Nisa in Arabia, the Happy. Mount Nisa is now Mount Sinai, folks. At the moment of the birth of Osiris, a voice sounded throughout the world saying, quote, "The Lord of all the earth is born," unquote. On the second day, Nut gave birth to Aroros, the elder Horus. On the third day, Typhon or Set. On the fourth day, Isis. And on the fifth and last day, Nephthys. The Egyptians, therefore, regard the 5 days, which they term the epact or superadded, as the birthdays of the gods, especially venerating the fourth of them upon which the benevolent goddess Isis came into being. Plutarch, further on, announces that the 5 children of Nut were not all of the same father, thus contradicting his earlier statement. For he says that Osiris and the elder Horus were the children of Ra, that Isis was the daughter of Thoth, and only Typhon and Nephthys were actually the offspring of Seb. There is another, an even more recondite legend regarding the elder Horus, which denies him the fathership of Ra, declaring him to be the offspring of Osiris and Isis, while they were still in the womb of Nut. Now, these accounts we shall consider later. Osiris was given to Pamelis to be educated, and having come to the years of majority, became the king of Egypt. In this high capacity, Osiris applied himself to the civilizing of his nation, turning the Egyptians from their previously indigent and barbarous course of life to a happy and community existence. He taught them agriculture, compiled for them a body of laws for the regulation of conduct, instructed them in the reverencing and worship of the gods, thus establishing Egypt in all the essentials of truth, according to the legend. And having brought his own nation to prosperity and enlightenment, Osiris traveled over the rest of the world, converting peoples to his disciplines, not by force, but the persuasion of reason. Osiris was accompanied on this journey by a procession of nymphs and other superphysical beings who filled the air with music and song. In the meantime, Typhon, brother or half-brother of Osiris, had ambition to usurp the throne, but the vigilant Isis, sister-wife of Osiris, was too watchful. Typhon, however, having persuaded 72 other persons to join him in his conspiracy, with the aid of a certain queen in Ethiopia named Aso, perfected a plot against Osiris. He fashioned a chest exactly to the measurement of the body of Osiris, which chest he caused to be brought into the banquet hall where the princes of Egypt were feasting their king's return. Typhon, simulating jest, promised this elaborately ornamented box to the one whose body, upon trial, most nearly fitted it. Now, each of the princes, in turn, lay down in the box, but each was too short or too tall, until last of all, Osiris himself lay down in it. Immediately, the 72 conspirators rushed to the box, clamped the cover up on it, fastened it with nails, and poured melted lead over all the cracks and crevices. After this, they carried the chest to the bank of the Nile and cast it into the river where it joins the sea. Now this evil deed was executed upon the 17th day of the Egyptian month of Athir, when the sun was in Scorpio. According to some, it was in the 28th year of the reign of Osiris, and to others in the 28th year of his life. Now try to remember these numbers. If you can't, jot them down, but these numbers will crop up again and again and again. Scorpio crops up, 17 crops up, 28 crops up, and many other numbers. And they all have significance in the mystery religion of Babylon, the secret societies, and to the guardians of the secrets of the ages. As soon as Isis received word of this crime, she cut off one of the locks of her hair and put on the mourning apparel of widowhood, for which reason the spot where she did this was afterwards called Koptos. That's Koptos, or the city of mourning. After donning the widow's weeds, Isis set forth in search of her husband's body and wandered about all Europe, wandered about all Egypt, asking all with whom she came in contact. You see, I may be back here in the United States, but a lot of my thoughts, folks, are still in Europe. Finally, some children who had been at play told Isis that they had seen the accomplices of Typhon carrying the chest to the Nile. For that reason, Egyptians regard the words of children as oracular and pay great attention to them. While Isis was searching for her husband's body, she learned that Nephthys, her sister, had by magic insinuated herself into the presence of Osiris before his death, and in the guise of Isis had conceived a son from him. Now Isis sought out the child, which Nephthys has deserted for fear of Typhon's anger, and adopting it, attached it to her person as a constant guard and attendant. This was Anubis, the dog-headed god, who appears in the Book of the Dead and in many of the Egyptian hieroglyphics. After some time, Isis learned that the chest had been carried by the sea to the coast of Byblos. Now, Byblos is also the name for book or Bible, where it had lodged in the branches of a bush of tamarisk, which had grown up miraculously about the sacred receptacle and concealed it within its trunk. Now, remember this tamarisk, and remember that it is a tree. The king of Byblos, amazed at the miracle, caused the tree to be cut down, and from the trunk containing the box, he made a pillar to support the roof of his palace. Now, by magic, Isis discovered this, and traveling immediately to Byblos, attached herself to the suite of the queen as a nurse to her children. At night, when all the palace was asleep, Isis transformed herself into a swallow and fluttered around the column, bemoaning her fate in strange, sad notes. In due time, Isis revealed her divine nature and asked that the pillar be cut down. Taking therefrom the chest, she departed with it into a desert place where she performed certain magical rites by which the body of Osiris was temporarily animated. And by this animation, she received from Osiris a son who is called the Younger Horus, the child who was conceived of the dead. Now there is some confusion in the account at this point. Plutarch says that Isis left the body of Osiris temporarily to visit her son Horus, just mentioned, but the context of the fable would rather call for her departure to a secluded place where the child could be born without the knowledge of Typhon, who certainly would have destroyed him. Isis hid the chest in a remote and unfrequented place, but Typhon, hunting one night by the light of the moon, chanced upon it. Knowing its contents, and realizing Isis to be proficient in magic, he resolved to thwart her purposes, and tearing the body into 14 parts, he scattered them over Egypt. Now remember, 14 parts. Folks, don't forget that. From the inscriptions on the Metternich stele, it seems that Set must have imprisoned Isis and her son Horus. The goddess is made to say, quote, I am Isis, and I came forth from the house wherein my brother Set had placed me, unquote. Thoth, the prince of law, again came to her assistance and aided Isis to escape from the house. Was it really a prison? Or was it really the house of Set? Thoth, also at this time, prophesied that Horus would sit upon the throne of his father and rule the double empire of Egypt. Upon the advice of Thoth, Isis hides the child in a papyrus swamp, thus saving him from the wrath of Set. Isis returning, having left her son at Butos, and fashioning a magical boat out of papyrus, traversed the whole of the empire. As she met with the scattered parts of her husband, she buried each one separately. First, however, encasing it in a magical mummy composed of wax, incense, and grain seed. She finally recovered all of the parts of Osiris except the phallus, or the penis, which had been thrown into the river and devoured by three fishes. This organ Isis reproduced in gold. Remember this also. Remember the three fishes, for they represent ignorance, superstition, and fear. They also represent the church, the state, and the mob. And remember that Isis reproduced this member, this organ, in gold, and having performed all of the ceremonies necessary to ensure the life of Osiris in the underworld, she returned to her son Horus, and by the theurgic arts of which she was mistress, saved him from death, from the stings of scorpions. Horus, having grown to man's estate, and having received from his mother the tradition of his father's murder, longed to avenge the evil deed. Osiris appeared to his son in a vision, instructing him in the means by which he could overcome the hosts of Typhon. Now we are led to infer that Horus gathered about him an army which, meeting the hosts of Typhon, battled with them for many days, achieving victory. Typhon, according to the legend, was taken prisoner and turned over to the custody of Isis. Now, Isis, being his sister, could not bring herself to put him to death, but set him at liberty, which so incensed Horus that he laid hands upon his mother and removed from her head the insignia of royalty. Thereupon, Thoth gave her a new helmet, made in the shape of an ox's head. Typhon next accused Horus of illegitimacy, but Thoth proves his royal descent. Typhon again goes into battle against Horus. In fact, two battles are mentioned, in both of which Typhon is worsted, and Horus regains the kingdom of his father and is regarded, to at least a certain degree, as the actual reincarnation of Osiris. So here you've had a death and a resurrection. After its resurrection in the underworld, the shade of Osiris visits Isis, and in consequence thereof, she gives birth to another son, as it were, by a Holy Ghost, for she knew no living man. This child is called Harpocrates, and Plutarch says of him that he, quote, came into the world before his time and lame in his lower limbs, unquote. Harpocrates is usually depicted as a nude figure, his head adorned with a single curling lock of hair on the right side, this being, with the Egyptians, a symbol of youth or adolescence. He is sometimes depicted with an elaborate plumed headdress or wearing the double crown of the northern and southern empires. His finger is placed to his lips, which Plutarch interprets as a gesture symbolic of his childish and helpless state. The Greeks and Romans, however, considered this gesture to be a symbol for silence or secrecy, and from this has arisen the custom of placing the finger to the lips as a motion for quietness and secrecy, and we do it today. Statues of the god Harpocrates were placed at the entrances to temples and sacred retreats where the dramas of the mysteries were performed. as a sign that silence and secrecy should be observed in the holy places, and that all initiates were bound by vows of discretion. Harpocrates is also sometimes shown standing, and at other times he is depicted seated on the blossom of a lotus, just like Buddha. Although he is usually figured with childish immaturity of body, the imperfection of his lower limbs, as described by Plutarch, is not apparent in any of the Egyptian drawings. It therefore seems that the statements concerning this deformity should be more carefully examined. Samuel Squire, whose translation of Plutarch's Isis and Osiris, made in 1744, is still the most often quoted by Egyptologists. Well, he states definitely, quote, lame in his lower limbs. G.R.S. Meade translated the same essay much later and gives a slightly different rendering of Plutarch's words. Mr. Meade says, quote, weak in his limbs from below upwards, unquote. This difference in wording, though slight, may have an unexpected significance. You see, there's some general information contained in Synesius's Treaty on Providence that should be included in this Osirian epic. Synesius is of the opinion that Osiris should be regarded as an historical king whose father, transcending in wisdom, instructed his benevolent son in all the secrets of the divine science of government. Synesius is moved to this conclusion by a desire to keep all speculation within the sphere of the reasonable. The Platonist bishop seems to have derived much of his account from origins foreign to Plutarch's treatise, or possibly he interpreted differently the restrictions imposed by his vows. Synesius, a prudent and conscientious author, wary of myths and fables, and exhibiting a truly Platonic conservativeness in his handling of subject matter, yet Synesius was beyond question a deeply religious philosopher and an initiate of pagan mysteries prior to his conversion to the Christian faith, and therefore may have hidden the true meaning of the fable. Thomas Taylor is of the mind that the treatise on Providence was written while Synesius was still a votary of pagan mysteries. Now, if so, the writing is unbiased and trustworthy and presents a fair picture of the mystical traditions of the Egyptians interpreted in terms of Platonic metaphysics, but only the exoteric could be allowed to be seen by the profane. Synesius inserts into his narrative a considerable description of the various character of Osiris, which he sharply contrasts with the vice-ridden nature of Typhon. He also explains, in detail, the process of election by which Osiris came to the throne of Egypt. The electional ceremony, as described by Synesius, is evidently itself a fragment from some secret ritual relating to the installation of a hierophant of the mysteries. Next, Osiris receives from his father an elaborate dissertation in the Platonic temper concerning the relative power of good and evil, in which he is fully warned against the machinations of Typhon. Possibly the most important sentence in Synesius's treatise occurs during this dissertation. The father of Osiris is made to say to his son, quote, you also have been initiated in those mysteries in which there are two pair of eyes, and it is requisite that the pair which are beneath should be closed when the pair that are above them perceive, and when the pair above are closed, those which are beneath should be opened, unquote. Now, these words unquestionably have an arcane meaning and are incorporated into the narrative that the true significance of the whole Osirian cycle might not be entirely obscured. And I can tell you that the meaning, folks, is that the eyes above are the exoteric meant for the outer world, for the profane, and the eyes below are the esoteric meant for the initiate, the adept, the priest of the mystery schools only. Synesius does not describe the death of Osiris, but merely reports his vanishment and final restoration to the throne. In the latter part of the story, there was also introduced a certain philosopher who was a stranger in Egypt. This philosopher predicts the fall of Typhon and is an eyewitness to the recrowning of Osiris. Synesius says of this philosopher, quote, "He likewise then learned some particulars about Osiris which would shortly happen, and others which would take place at some greater distance of time, vis-a-vis when the boy Horus would choose as his associate in battle a wolf instead of a lion. But who the wolf is a sacred narration, which it is not holy to divulge even in the form of a fable," unquote. Well, the lion, we know, has always been of the tribe of Judah. Such is the amazing tradition of the good king Osiris, the first victim, the first mummy, and the first resurrection. He dies and is born again in three forms. First, as god of the underworld, where he rules the justified dead. Second, as the younger Horus, in whose form he battles for his own honor. And third, as Harpocrates, the silent child. The latter two forms are regarded as incarnations or embodiments of his very self, yet he exists independent of them as the judge of shades and the lord of the resurrection. Now we know that Osiris was also known as the sun, and Horus was known as the child, or the young Osiris, the young Horus, the baby Horus. So after the sun set in the west, when it rose the next morning, it rose as the young Horus, and as it went across the sky, it became Osiris and then the elder. But in the legends, it's differently at different times, Osiris or Horus. Horus the younger, Horus at his peak strength at noon, and Horus the elder. It is also Osiris. So you see that these figures intermingle in the legend, but it all has meaning, and it will all be clear to you at a later time. Now, just because you don't understand some of this and you may be a little lost, don't worry, it will come together. Don't miss one single word of this series of episodes of The Hour of the Time. If you do, I can guarantee you will regret it for the rest of your life. We're going to stop right now, folks. We have to take a break. I will be back right after this very short pause.